It's kind of a taverna type society. A lot of people sitting around, a lot of people drinking coffee, smoking cigarettes, leisurely pace, 2-hour lunches.
Popular misconceptions abound in the reporting of the Greek debt crisis. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Also on the show this week, the true story behind Linda Taylor, better known as Ronald Reagan's infamous welfare queen.
She was investigated for homicide, kidnapping, baby trafficking. Reagan didn't mention any of those things.
And Russian comedian Yakov Smirnov tells us about dealing with a particularly harsh critic, his own government.
I would say, you know, in Russia, they would say we have freedom of speech. But in America, you have freedom after you speak, which is a nice little feature.
There's more coming up after this.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, all eyes have been fixed on Greece, specifically on whether the new leftist government's refusal to accept further austerity measures and its subsequent inability to make a 1.6 billion euro debt payment to the IMF will lead to the country's exit from the eurozone. As of this recording, the endgame remains unclear, but a thread running through all of the coverage is a sense of certainty that Greece has nobody to blame but itself.
Greece got bailed out. But you read the Wall Street Journal, got bailed out by other European countries. It was going broke.
To which much of the world responds, stop whining. Greece's problems are its own fault.
In other words, what goes around comes around, which is an understandable sentiment for European taxpayers who believe they're picking up the tab for somebody else's laziness and irresponsibility. Except, according to political economist Mark Blythe, that narrative itself is lazy and irresponsible. Mark, welcome to the show.
Nice to be here.
Let's begin by explaining how we got to the point we're at, and I'm going to give you 30 seconds.
30 seconds on the biggest mess in European history. Okay, it goes like this. They invented a currency called the euro. And when you join the euro, you give up your own printing press. Consequently, financial markets go, yippee, because that means your bonds are now going to be much, much more reliable in terms of their pricing. So countries like Greece were effectively able to borrow like Germany for about 7 years. And that was all fine until the global financial crisis hit. And then everyone said, hang on a minute, Greece isn't Germany. They're up to their eyeballs in debt and they'll never pay it back.
So can we just tick down the allegations and tell me what the facts are? One of the ongoing assumptions is that the Greeks have simply been living beyond their means, subsidizing the welfare state, pensions and unemployment and government giveaways.
Greece basically concealed how much it was spending on things like a generous pension system.
We see irresponsible nations like Greece who need international funds to continue their profligate spending.
Most of the countries in the eurozone were actually decreasing their debt going into the crisis. And even the Greeks, if you look at it over a 5-year period going into the financial crisis, it was flat. There was no orgy of spending. This just isn't true. Let's think about pensions. Why did the Greeks spend 16% of GDP on pensions? Because they're the fifth oldest country in the world. So what happens if you then take the fifth oldest country in the world and reduce their pensions, which, by the way, are completely average in terms of their payouts? You will have more old, poor people who will spend less in the middle of a recession. I'm not clear to me why that helps.
The question of labor force competitiveness.
Greece pursued a very inflationary policy. They were not competitive.
Very tough structural reforms ultimately are going to be necessary to restore Greece to competitiveness.
Right. So on that one, it's absolutely true that labor became more expensive and basically wages went up. Those wages have now adjusted. They've adjusted to the point that a quarter of the country is unemployed and the youth unemployment figure is 50%. So they, by definition, are astonishingly competitive because half the country is desperate for a job. Jobs being done, why is there no growth?
Here's another item from the bill of indictment, that Europe has poured all of these billions of euros into Greece and that they're still overspending and unable to make a go of things.
They just cannot set the precedent of letting Greece be as reckless as they are and continue to bail them out.
Sometimes it feels like they think the money's free. There were never any strings attached. Yep, the people running Greece seem to believe that this whole drama will play out in a fairy tale fashion.
The Greeks have been given 249 billion euros in loans. About 205 went straight back to the creditors, otherwise known as the banks. Hardly any of it stayed in Greece. The bit that was used to finance Greece's government operations was a tiny percentage of the total. And yet, all we hear is that the Greeks have got all this money and spent it again. It's just rubbish. It's just flatly wrong.
The working hours, the productivity, they're just basking in the sun and drinking retsina while Northern Europe slaves away.
It's kind of a taverna-type society. A lot of people sitting around, a lot of people drinking coffee, smoking cigarettes, leisurely pace, two-hour lunches. And now you're telling me this translates into the workplace, correct?
The only people who are drinking retsina are financial journalists who can't be bothered going to their computer and looking up some numbers. Look up international comparisons of labour hours worked. The Germans work about 1,350. The Greeks work over 2,000. They have an old, unproductive economy, and they rely on tourism, and everybody works two jobs for low pay, so they're relatively unproductive. This is a structural fact of an old economy in the wrong place, not because they're lazy.
The tax collections are pitiful.
Greece and taxes. Why the country is in desperate financial straits? Because residents won't pay up.
Last year, the government announced that Greece is owed 76 billion euros in unpaid taxes.
You have doctors with swimming pools reporting income that, you know, a street sweeper ought to be earning.
It's true, they don't pay taxes, but you know what? Neither do we in the United States. How many billions are sitting offshore because American corporations won't pay corporation tax? Turns out rich people all over the place don't pay taxes. One of the things that's annoying about this is the Monday morning quarterbacking that's going on with this. There's a financial publication, used to be called Euroweek. They gave their 2007 award for Sovereign Borrower of the Year to the Hellenic Republic. The markets loved Greece. They were falling all over them to give them money. Now, if they all knew it was corrupt and they were lazy and shiftless and all the rest of it, why were they falling hands over fist to award them for taking their cash?
So from your perspective, the people to blame here are not the Greeks, but the bankers who are asking Europe to cover their bad debts.
So it's not a question of Greece is blameless. Of course they're blameful. But that doesn't matter. If people were giving them money, you can't have overborrowing without overlending. Why is all the conversation about the terrible overborrowers rather than the reckless overlenders?
What's the worst thing you've seen in the reporting of the Greek crisis?
Oh, every day I find myself thumping my head off the desk. The one that really annoys me is the fact that nobody gets called on their busted calls. So, you know, the number of times I've seen Europe has turned a corner into growth and they went straight back into recession, right? If you're a bookie and you continually make bad bets, you go out of business, right? If you're a doctor and you continually injure patients, they put you in jail. But if you're a financial journalist or an institutional economist, then you can make bad call, bad bet, and bad policy time after time, and you get promoted. That's what's most annoying about it. Nobody calls you on your errors.
Now, I think I should observe here that you're coming from a particular point of view, a kind of a leftist economist point of view. Your quibble doesn't seem to be so much with the coverage of the Greek debt crisis, but with the euro regime itself. You just think it's anti-democratic and designed for failure.
Well, as the Germans say, yein, yes and no simultaneously. I'm actually a fan of the political project. The ability to put democracy and rule of law all the way up to the borders of Ukraine with barely a shot being fired, Serbia notwithstanding, has been a remarkable achievement. I just think that when you start to do things like replace governments and have something called the Eurogroup, which decides that a government shouldn't be in power, that's kind of dangerous. I don't think that's kind of leftist or rightist or whatever. And everything that I've said here is based on evidence, chapter and verse, real data, the whole thing. It's not a set of just, I just made this up opinions. And what gets me is the sort of the faith-based reasoning on the other side, which is, well, the Greeks haven't tried hard enough. Well, I can show you evidence that they've actually done a heck of a lot of reform. Yeah, but that doesn't count because they're all lazy. But in fact, they work like 800 hours more than the Germans. Yeah, but they don't pay taxes. Yeah, but neither do rich people in the United States. And you can go after point after point after point, and it makes no difference. This is an article of faith.
Mark, thank you so much.
Pleasure. I'll go back to my commie cell now.
Mark Blythe is an economist and professor at Brown University's Watson Institute of International and Public Affairs.
Coming up, two infamous women whose stories were mistold by the media.
This is On the Media. Hey, podcast listeners, we want you to subscribe to our nifty little newsletter. And if you do, you will be entered to win a signed copy of my New York Times worst-selling comic novel, Bedfellows, and Brooke's critically acclaimed graphic media manifesto, The Influencing Machine. There will be five winners. Of course, you're already entered if you're already a subscriber, whether you like it or not. Got to do it by July 31st. To subscribe, go to onthemedia.org.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In this segment, we'll unpack the stories of two very different women whose lives were appropriated by the media. The first, a tragedy that became a funny media meme. The other, a life condensed to a phrase that came to stand in for racism and anti-poverty rhetoric. Our coverage begins with a story revisited last year in the New York Times online documentary series Retro Report, The Strange, Tragic Case of Lindy Chamberlain. In 1982, Chamberlain was convicted in an Australian court of murdering her 9-week-old infant daughter, Azaria, who had vanished on a family camping trip in the outback. Chamberlain claimed the baby had been snatched from the tent by an indigenous wild dog called a dingo. The episode scandalized a nation, but also came to enthrall the world, and to this day persists in the popular imagination thanks to one unexpected exclamation.
The dingo took my baby!
That's Meryl Streep as Chamberlain from the 1988 film A Cry in the Dark. The Retro Report examined Chamberlain's trial, conviction, and eventual exoneration stretched over 30 years and the media circus that surrounded it. Jennifer Ford directed and produced the Retro Report. When we spoke to her last year, she told us that doubts about Chamberlain's story began with a sort of dingo jingoism, a romantic Aussie notion of the native animal's sunny disposition.
Everybody in Australia at that time believed it to be a wild dog, but basically timid. So whilst initially everybody local believed her story, when outsiders started to come in, police and journalists, people started to suspect the parents and indeed Lindy for having murdered her baby.
This was a case, as it turned out, of jaw-dropping incompetence by police and forensics experts and by the media, which became a sort of whole nation full of Nancy Graces looking for reasons to convict Lindy Chamberlain in the press. And she kind of helped in a way because her demeanor was so strange, was it not?
I think that was one of the things that was confusing to people, that she was dealing with her anguish. She didn't break down in public. She was able to speak very rationally about it. And she did this one interview in particular, which really turned people.
Were you surprised Azaria's clothing was found hardly torn?
No, not really. Not having watched wild dingoes feed on cattle and things like that.
They pull back the skin as they go, and they'll just peel it like an orange.
Whilst that's true, I think people just found it very surprising that she would be able to sort of answer so clinically. But really, she's just answering the question.
It was as if she had sat on the witness stand confessing as far as the public was concerned.
Right. And then during the trial, it must have been very difficult to be there on the stand listening to these ridiculous scenarios. She was sort of short-tempered with the prosecution, which didn't come across well to the jury.
Concerning the accusation at the time of the trial that she was just too unemotional, she told you in the film that she was between a rock and a hard place.
If I smiled, I was belittling my daughter's death. If I cried, I was acting. The point is, until you go through something, you have no idea how you yourself will react.
Ultimately, she is on trial for her personality. immediately after it had happened, when the press came in, I think Lindy wanted to share her experience with people and make other people aware of the dangers. Instantly, there was a backlash and people couldn't understand why she wasn't openly breaking down in front of the cameras. Her lawyers apparently suggested to her before she went to trial that she didn't show emotion. She said to us she felt like that was bad advice. And indeed, there are several accounts of how she did break down in court, but they just went unreported.
The prosecution shows up with no body, very little physical evidence, and no murder weapon, and she was convicted and sent to prison.
Well, Lindy had always maintained that her baby had been wearing a little jacket over the jumpsuit that was initially found in the search immediately after her baby's disappearance. But they never found this jacket. And very quickly, people decided that she had invented the jacket. No dingo saliva or hairs were found on the jumpsuit. So she had said, well, because she was wearing a jacket, the evidence of the dingo would be on the jacket. And when no one found the jacket, people said, oh, well, look, you've just made up the jacket.
Then what happened?
3.5 years after she'd been incarcerated, some searchers were out looking for the body of a climber who had fallen to his death. They found the jacket. And less than a week later, Lindy was let out of prison.
Her nightmare did not end there. In fact, it's only very recently that the coroner report attributed Azaria's death to a dingo attack. Bizarrely, one of the reasons that she has not been able to escape the narrative that was built around her was that one line we heard uttered by Meryl Streep. When it came out of Lindy Chamberlain's own mouth, it sounded like this.
There wasn't time to go and tell people. I just yelled out, has anyone got a torch? The dingo's got my baby.
For whatever reason, the line actually made Lindy, a woman who had lost her child, an object of ridicule in a way we've seldom seen before. Here's a little montage.
Maybe the dingo ate your baby.
Hey, I think I hear a dingo eating your baby.
Yeah, what? Well, ooh!
A dingo ate my baby.
A dingo ate my baby!
The dingo took my baby. It mutated into a dingo ate my baby. Is, to this day, a global punchline. Why did that happen, do you suppose, and what effect has it had on the travails of Lindy Chamberlain?
I mean, that was one of the big questions that we had coming into the story. Maybe that the word dingo was a funny word to the American ears. It sounded like some sort of strange, mythical creature. There was another suggestion that perhaps the ridicule was more about Meryl Streep, that at the time she was taking quite a lot of parts and she was doing funny accents. So it may have been that Meryl was the figure of fun more than Lindy. But nevertheless, it's just amazing that it captured the public imagination, even though it was so far removed from the story. I think it's such an intriguing thing, and I'm not sure that we've really answered that question.
When you did the film, did you ask her about this line and how it's come to transcend even the bizarre details of the prosecution itself?
A little bit. She didn't have a huge amount to say about that because I think that it's a very American thing. You had an American film about an Australian story, and Americans at that point were meant to get it, and Australians were meant to get it. And then they just kind of veer off in totally different directions. Lindy is still struggling on with trying to get justice. Australians aren't quite buying it. And then in America, this line is really what people took away from it. Lots of people today, I think, don't really know that it is a true story.
She was characterized as a kind of femme fatale, as a religious cultist. She and her husband were Seventh-day Adventists, a fairly exotic religion in Australia. And this narrative, some of it persists in Australia to this day. People still think she did it.
What the prosecution managed to do was concoct a gripping story, and Lindy's public demeanor lent itself very well to the key villain. And the defense had a hard time countering that. I think the fact that she was a woman is really key. I don't think it would have played out in quite the same way if her husband had been the one who was accused. When I was doing my research, I spoke to a Reuters journalist who covered this case and subsequently went on to cover the Amanda Knox trial in Italy. And he said that there were great similarities, that there was a really fine line between being good-looking and being too good-looking. They were sort of sexy women and people just didn't trust them. They were almost too attractive for the case.
Jennifer, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Jennifer Ford is a producer for Retro Report. She directed and produced the documentary about Lindy Chamberlain, which you can find on nytimes.com.
Back on the campaign trail in 1976, Ronald Reagan told a story about an unnamed woman whose crimes were almost too brazen to be believed.
To collect food stamps, Social Security, veterans' benefits for four non-existent deceased veterans' husbands, as well as welfare. Her tax-free cash income alone has been running $150,000 a year.
In October of the same year, her fraud had escalated.
She has used 127 names so far, posed as a mother of 14 children at one time, seven at another, and once while on welfare, posed as an open-heart surgeon, complete with office.
Josh Levine, executive editor at Slate, investigated the story of Linda Taylor, America's original welfare queen, for a 2013 article. So, take us back to the 80s. Reagan is president. He gave the press a ready-made symbol for the problem of welfare. Was Linda Taylor really the kind of criminal that he portrayed her as?
The welfare stuff was a pretty narrow slice of this woman's criminal career. She was investigated for homicide, kidnapping, baby trafficking. Reagan didn't mention any of those things. He would quote a lot of figures, $150,000 she had made, $1 million she had made. But his focus was pretty narrowly on the public aid theft.
The welfare queen, however, was not entirely Reagan's creation. The Chicago Tribune had a big hand in this. So could you discuss the role of the press in this story?
Sure. George Bliss was a Pulitzer Prize winning writer for the Tribune. And he wrote a lot of stories about public aid problems in Illinois. You know, he would have headlines about state probing Medicaid problems. Good journalism, but not something that'll make you spit out your morning coffee. And then he found the welfare queen.
For most news outlets, the welfare queen seems to be where the story of Linda Taylor began and pretty much ended. Because you suggested it wasn't in anyone's interest to tell the whole story.
By naming her the welfare queen, the Tribune could narrow its focus on this public aid crisis that they believed was happening. Ronald Reagan could make a point about a policy angle that he wanted to pursue and try to appeal to working class voters who would be very offended by this sort of theft. Reagan's opponents could say that Reagan was fibbing or that he was exaggerating her crimes. You know, and the police, politicians were in their ear saying, we've got to put a handle on this. And, you know, her other crimes, the kidnappings, the, you know, alleged homicide, those were very difficult to investigate. And, you know, the political will, it seemed to me, was really pointing them towards focusing on getting her welfare stuff under control.
So is there a hero in your story?
If there is one, I think it's the Chicago police detective, Jack Sherwin. He runs across this woman. She files a false burglary report, kind of an insurance scam situation. He writes her up for that. The second time, different woman, different apartment, different part of town, similar situation, false burglary report. She was wearing a different wig the second time that he met her. She was kind of a master of disguise. The head of the Legislative Advisory Committee on Public Aid would say she's black, but she could also look Asian and, you know, Latino and white. And that was kind of the mystique around her, that she was such a shapeshifter.
What tipped off Sherwin that the person he'd seen a couple of years earlier filing a false report was the person he now suspected of filing a false report?
Well, the scam was so similar. She was claiming that her fur and jewelry and whatnot had been stolen. There was something that, like, caused a tingle. He asked her to go get a glass of water for him, and he ran the fingerprints off the glass. And that's how he discovered that it was the same person. And he started digging and found out that she maybe had seven different husbands, all these different names and addresses.
Sherwin feels that even though she was convicted, she ultimately beat the system.
Right. She was convicted of welfare fraud and perjury for lying to a grand jury about the different names that she used. She wasn't in prison for more than 4 or 5 years. And as far as I could tell, she didn't go to prison after that for possible murders. She was never convicted of any of the alleged kidnappings. Back in the 60s, a cop found that she had kids that didn't belong to her on a couple of different occasions, but the children were returned and no charges were ever filed.
Except for one child.
Right. In 1964, there was a child named Paul Joseph Fronczak who was taken from his mother's arms in a Chicago hospital by a woman dressed as a nurse. It was written about everywhere. There were hundreds of cops looking into this, 50 FBI agents, 35,000 people interviewed in connection to this case.
Do you have an appeal to the kidnapper?
I pray that she'll take care of the baby and return him.
Nobody was ever arrested. The child has never been found to this day, 50 years later.
Linda Taylor, as we're calling her, switched race and age when convenient. Could you say that there's a sort of parallel between her protean shape-shifting and the way her story reflected prevailing attitudes about race?
Here's an answer. It was around the 1960s that you started to see the phrase welfare mess appear in the press and out of the mouths of legislators. And that was when more African Americans started being added to the welfare rolls. Benefits that had previously been denied were being granted to folks that were, in fact, eligible for them. Robert Byrd, the senator, held these very racially charged hearings about, you know, how the money was going to women and their paramours and, you know, being spent on alcohol. And images around this time of poverty and magazines went from usually depicting white folks to depicting black folks, far out of proportion to the numbers that were receiving welfare. And so fast forward to the 1970s when Ronald Reagan starts talking about this woman. She's written about in the press as a black woman. You know, Reagan never said this woman is black. But voters, I think, could infer that that's what he was talking about. And I think that's the image that has certainly persisted in people's minds when you hear the term welfare queen.
One of the many ironies in your story is that although Ronald Reagan dusted off the welfare queen's lurid misadventures, arguing, as you say, that rampant fraud demanded decisive government action, in fact, most of the savings he recouped wasn't in cutting fraud, but in cutting benefits. And so it continues, right?
Right. I think, you know, there's currently a debate going on about food stamps and cutting from that program. There's the idea that we can just cut out fraud and abuse and that will save billions upon billions of dollars. But I think it's just really a myth.
You quote Eric Schnurrer in The Atlantic saying that none of the savings in the current food stamp cuts would come from fraud, but purely from funding and tightening the benefits.
Right. But when you hear politicians try to sell it on the House floor to their constituents, you still hear the same kind of language about, isn't it so frustrating when you see someone in the grocery store with king crab legs and then they put it on the EBT card. It's just this idea that the people who are getting food stamps or the people who are getting any kind of other kind of public aid, they just don't deserve it. And so if we cut it, we're not cutting off anyone who might need this to feed their family. We're cutting off the king crab leg people.
Josh, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Josh Levine is executive editor at Slate, and his story in Slate is called The Welfare Queen.
Coming up, you think the U.S. media are under the heel of the man? Don't tell that to Yakov Smirnov.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The notion of using broad laws to suppress dissent has a long and horrifying tradition in Russia. The Soviets enforced a censorship regime ranging from the brutal to the ridiculous. Not only were wayward writers confined to gulags and insane asylums, or worse, even comedians were under the thumb of the state. Yakov Smirnov is a Soviet-born comic who emigrated in the late 70s to the U.S., where part of his comedy was about his previous life.
I am actually from Russia. I was born there, grew up there, worked as a comedian out there. What surprises me, American people don't know we have comedy in Russia. We have comedians. They're there. They're dead. They're there. It's very hard to do comedy in Soviet Union. You have to write out all your material, and you send it to Department of Jokes. I'm not making this up. They send it back.
He wasn't making it up. Well, except for the name Department of Jokes, which was actually the humor department of the censorship apparatus within the Soviet Ministry of Culture. Smirnov says that once a year, comedians had to submit their jokes to the Department of Humor for approval and were prohibited from straying in any way from the approved text in their acts.
We had pretty strict guidelines. We couldn't talk about government, politics, religion, or sex. The rest was fine.
In other words, 97.3% of all the subject matter of all comedians all over the world throughout history.
Yeah, we can talk about fish, buttons, animals. Those are very hot topics, you know.
Now, for the last 25 or 30 years here in the West, you have been a fairly traditional stand-up comedian. But
yes,
there was no stand-up tradition in Russia back in the 70s and 80s. What was your act?
It was more of the older version of comedy that was during the vaudeville time here. And I would deliver the material that was approved. And if somebody heckled from the audience, I would say, well, come back in a year when I can approve some comeback line to you, you know.
Nothing ad lib, not even dealing with hecklers.
No, not at all. I would say, you know, in Russia, they would say we have freedom of speech, but in America, you have freedom after you speak, which is a nice little feature.
Allowing for the fact that translation doesn't always work, can you tell me some of your material from the old days so we can get a notion of what Soviet comedy sounds like in translation?
Well, I'll tell you, like one of the jokes was about an ant and an elephant. Little ant got married to female elephant. And after first wedding night, elephant died. And the little ant said, only one night I enjoyed myself. And now for the rest of my life, I have to dig this grave. That was okay. A couple of jokes that did not make it. The Soviet leader was cracking down on alcohol problem that's happening there. And so he goes to a factory and he says to one of the workers, if you had a glass of vodka, could you work today? And the guy said, I guess I could. And if you had two glasses of vodka, could you work? He said, I guess I could. If you had three glasses of vodka, could you work? He said, I'm here, aren't I? So that joke did not pass through the government. The other one that I thought was funny did not pass either was about buying a car. And it took like 20 years to get a car in Soviet Russia at that time. And the guy goes to, to the factory and says, I'd like to buy a car. And he said, well, okay, put your name on the list. Come back in 20 years, pick up the car. The guy said, do I come back in the morning or in the afternoon? And the manager said, what's the difference? It's 20 years from now. The guy said, the plumber is scheduled to come that morning. That did not pass.
I want to ask you about what's going on now in Russia. It's hard to look at Putin's actions without hearing these echoes of Soviet repression. He's becoming increasingly autocratic, increasingly intolerant of dissent. People are going to jail for various crimes, real and imagined. But there's also the risk of overstating the threat that Putin poses vis-a-vis a genuine evil empire like the Soviet Union. What is your level of horror?
Whatever it is that is going on, I see the same thing that I grew up with starting to happen again. The new law that just happened a couple of days ago, that you cannot have bad language in any media. It's a very simple formula. Divide and conquer. It's get rid of all the things that might influence people, and then you're the sole source of information, and that's part of the plan. He is like a chess player. He understands how there's certain elements he needs to be able to control, and the media is one of the things that is in competition with him, and that's how the old Russian regime, Stalin, and all those guys were functioning at that time.
The Cold War was great for defense contractors and Yakov Smirnov. You had something to joke about, and you were very current in the 70s and the 80s.
Yes.
And then something horrible happened. The Berlin Wall fell. The Soviet Empire disintegrated, and you suddenly became less interesting. Is there a part of you that wants Putin to turn into a bona fide communist-style dictator so you can get back at the top of the bill?
The answer is no. When the Berlin Wall came down and the Soviet Union collapsed, David Letterman had a top 10 list of things that will now change that the Soviet Union is no longer there. Number one on the list is Yakov Smirnov will be out of work, which I thought was funny, but it really wasn't, because it exactly came for tuition and all of my contracts in Vegas, Atlantic City, and et cetera, were no longer renewed. So I started looking for a place where they did not know that the Soviet Union collapsed. And I found my place in Branson, Missouri, where I now own and operate 2,000 seat theater. So I'm okay. I don't need Putin to rebuild the Soviet Union for me to make a living.
So both Branson and Crimea have been uninformed
about the
collapse of the empire. I see.
That's correct.
Yakov, thank you so much.
Thank you for talking to me.
Decades of research has not yet yielded a machine capable of delivering a tight 10 minutes of observational humor, but computers can, under certain circumstances, grind out a joke. Recently, Joel Warner and Peter McGraw, authors of The Humor Code, A Global Search for What Makes Things Funny, pitted comedian Mike Kaplan against Manatee, a computer created to tell jokes. Last year, Joel Warner asked me if I could tell the difference between a human joke and one that isn't.
Okay, you're going to guess now.
Okay.
I like thrills like I like flights. Cheap.
Cheap thrills, cheap flights. I think that since cheap in this context is being used as kind of salacious, sexy, that was the human, Mike.
You are incorrect.
Oh.
That was Manatee.
All right. Another?
I like fingers like I like my notes. Sticky.
That's the computer.
Yes.
Actually, artificial intelligence researchers have been studying computers and humor for a long time.
Yeah. Among my favorites would be LibJob, which is the light bulb joke generator, the double entendre noun transfer program, which figures out where inside passages of text to insert the line, "That's what she said."
The current effort, the one that yielded Manatee, was a $700,000 government project?
Yes. Project received stimulus funding. And when Republicans heard that a joke computer received $700,000, they were fuming.
How can you justify that?
I think there's a valid reason. We spend so much time with our gizmos. We want the interactions to be as smooth and fluid as possible. In some ways, we want these things to almost be a bit human. I mean, who wouldn't want a GPS device that, after you ignore it for the 20th time, it somehow sarcastically rolls its eyes at you?
I would say almost everybody wouldn't want that. But I'm sure there's another example.
Well, think about when a web page doesn't load now.
Yeah.
Designers think we might be a little more okay with a stumble if a computer almost makes humor about it.
I guess if it were real. Personifying a program can also run into a lot of problems. I mean, Clippy, may he rest in peace, was probably the most deeply unpopular thing ever produced by, what, Microsoft?
If Clippy made fun of himself, say, hey, I know you don't like me, but you pressed the wrong button, and here I am. I'm going to do my little Clippy dance. I mean, that, right? That might help make things a little more...
You are so right.
One of the examples of human intelligence is our ability to process all this information around us and find new and novel ways to make things funny. So it's actually a really good challenge, a really good goal.
Do humans really understand what makes things funny?
That's a very good question. There have been many attempts over the centuries to figure out what exactly makes things funny. You can go back to Plato and Aristotle, who said it was about superiority, laughing at the misfortune of other people. Then came the incongruity theory by folks like Kant, who said that humor arises when you're led to believe one thing and something else happens. Setups and punchlines work well. And then there was Freud, of course, who had his own theory.
Based on sexual frustration, no doubt.
Of course.
And do you have a favorite?
I have to say I'm partial to the one my co-author and I looked at in the book, The Humor Code. His name is Peter McGraw, and his theory is something called the benign violation theory. The idea that humor arises when something seems benign while simultaneously appears to be a violation or somehow wrong.
Of course, all of these can be right.
Yeah. There hasn't been enough hard and fast research to say this is it. This is the end-all, be-all of humor research.
Okay. So a guy is going down the street, and he sees his friend. He hasn't seen him for I don't know how long. And he has this big orange head. And he goes up to him, and he goes, hey, what's with the big orange head? And he goes, you know, it's a funny story. I was in an antique shop, and I found this lamp, and I rubbed it, and a genie came out and gave me three wishes. And so I wish for a gorgeous house. And you see behind me this huge mansion? Yeah, it's really nice. That's the house. And then I wished for a beautiful wife. And you see that really lovely blonde coming down the street? That's my wife. And then here's where I think I went wrong. I wished for a big orange head.
The amount of kind of human intelligence that you and I have to one, tell that joke and create that joke and then appreciate it. I mean,
the
can you imagine?
The smartest person I know did not get that joke.
I think it's less about pure intelligence, but I mean, how you process the world, how you see the world. I mean, how are you going to teach a computer to do that?
But if we were to do that, would that be the apotheosis of artificial intelligence?
Some people have suggested that one of the ultimate tests is to get a computer to tell jokes and appreciate jokes in all their forms. I think we're still a ways off on that.
What was the best joke told in the contest?
Oh, okay. I have to say the one that sums the whole contest up. I like jokes like I like robots. Efficient and killer.
And whose joke was that?
Thankfully for the human race, that was Mike Kaplan.
Joel, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Joel Warner wrote with Peter McGraw, The Humor Code, a global search for what makes things funny. Mike, that's M-Y-Q, Kaplan, is the comedian that competed with Manatee, the computer. He was chosen in part for his, quote, robotic delivery.
Had some other jobs. I talked to a street musician once, found out that you can make up to $60 an hour being a street musician, or up to $60 a minute robbing a street musician, so...
It's hard, isn't it? Just standing there alone on the high wire?
I mean, it's a subjective thing. I'll do a show for military, and they'll come up after and say, I could never do what you do, and I'm like, well, that's... You know, it's not... I could say the same, you know, like, worst case scenario for me is a room full of people doesn't like me. That's something I dealt with in high school every day.
Some say your comedy has been described as robotic, and your new album is called Meat Robot.
I definitely understand that. I like relationships and friendships, but I don't always necessarily outwardly manifest those emotions as much as other people do. So people like, for example, when I was married, I remember my wife would call me husbot. Now it's ex-husbot. Perfect.
Some comedians might have been afraid that they would lose to a robot.
I mean, comedy is subjective. There are, I'm sure, people who think that this robot is better than me. Either way, I was excited to be part of the story. If I win, then hooray for humanity. And if I lose, then we're the ones who made the computers. So it's still a win for humanity, at least.
So the structure of this was very simple.
Yes.
I like this like I like this.
Mm-hmm.
Was that a structure you'd used before?
It's sort of a comedy trope. The robot can find, oh, these two words mean the same thing, but in different situations, people might not have thought of that. So here is an incongruity. Is that a joke? That's my impression of the robot.
So how do you think the robot did at that?
I think it did great. I don't think they were the most sophisticated jokes of this type even, but I think they made sense. Most people are not the best when they start doing comedy, and I think this robot is off to a great start.
Let's grade some of Manatee's jokes.
Mm-hmm.
I like fingers like I like my notes. Sticky?
Yeah, that one, I guess, now thinking about it, that one could use some more work, I guess. Like, I like fingers didn't really... Oh, why do you like fingers? Like, nobody would ever say, I like fingers, unless there's some real specific great payoff of why they like fingers. But in that situation, it seems like it just thought, oh, it's seen the term sticky fingers and sticky notes. There's no real, like, you know, depth.
Resonance,
yeah,
there.
It's
just about words. I like periods like I like my verbs. Irregular?
This robot is talking about a woman's cycle. That's if a robot were to perform, I think that would be the sort of the same way that, you know, Betty White, she's been funny for her whole life, but there's a specific thing that now is even, like, more incongruous about our idea of what an old person is supposed to talk about. It's like she doesn't even have to say a specifically funny thing, but people will think it's funny because it's an old person talking about sex.
Given the state of artificial intelligence these days, do you think this had any meaning? We can't really learn anything about humans by making a computer make a joke. It's still purely technical.
I guess the ideal is, like, I don't want, you know, robots taking my jobs. But as long as I keep working and as long as every other comedian can, like, maybe robots can be trained enough to, you know, go into hospital wards. And, you know, the 23 hours a day that there's not a comedian there, they're like, what do you think about these jokes, robots? Or, like, you know, into an old folks home or, you know, doing a benefit for veterans. Literally, I have no idea what people are planning on doing with joke robots, if anything. So, no greater meaning.
So what advice would you give Manatee?
Write and perform as much as possible, you know, figure out what works, bring it to the people. You've got a great avenue right now being the only joke robot, but I would say try to take a lower profile initially, just write a lot and then try things out on smaller crowds. Then I assume you'll get to a point where, you know, you might overtake me and I don't want that to happen. So I'd say, you know, just try to live a more fulfilling life, you know, become a service robot if you would. What do you want? What do you really want, Manatee?
Can I tell you this joke?
Of course.
Okay, you may have heard this before.
It's possible.
If you have, just stop me.
Sure.
Okay, so there's this guy, and he sees an old friend of his he hasn't seen for a long time, and he has a big orange head.
This is my favorite joke.
It's your favorite joke.
I love it so much.
Sometimes the smartest people just don't get it.
Do you want to hear my theory?
Yes.
If you heard for the first time, why did the chicken cross the road, you're expecting some grand answer, but the answer is to get to the other side. You know, the expectation is it's something, so the dashing of that expectation is that it's nothing, which is the same thing here. You probably had heard so many jokes about genies where people wish for something and it goes slightly awry. I didn't say a 12-inch pianist, you know? I didn't say a million ducks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your brain has become practiced in the art of understanding that that's what's going on here. These other people who don't get it, they're just people who, I guess, led lives full of not enough jokes.
It's so funny because the big orange head joke is my favorite joke, too.
It's wonderful.
I always thought it was because the answer is that human beings just do stupid things. Just really idiotic choices.
I mean, your interpretation is by no means incorrect.
Mm-hmm. But it's true that in the moment, which is where you live as a comedian, it would be, well, we all know, you know, the genie trope.
Yes. You bring this greater human meaning to it, but I don't think anyone could not have heard any jokes like them and still feel that exact same way about it. So it's certainly not the only thing at play, but it's definitely a portion of it.
I have this brilliant friend. I think you're right. A, she doesn't have enough jokes in her life, even though she laughs a lot, but not at jokes. And B, I don't think that she immediately goes to the place that human beings just make completely illogical choices.
So you say, well, wish for a big orange head. And she's like, well, why would he do that? That doesn't seem like the thing to do. What's the rest of the joke?
Thank you so much, Mike.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Kimi Regler, Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, and Sam Dingman. We had more help from Maya Brownstein. And this week, we bid farewell to two people, our most excellent intern, Jenna Cagle, and assistant producer, Kasia Mihailovic. We will miss you. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Greg Rippon.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.